This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
Thank you, Myron. Well, good afternoon. It is good to see you here. Some of you, it's good to see you back again after the other session. Internal controls. What are we talking about in terms of internal controls? Maybe to demonstrate a bit, how many of you brush your teeth at least once a month? Good. How many of you wash your car at least once a day? And how many of you think I got those questions backward? Sometimes when we look at internal controls, it's a little like asking those questions. It can feel like, in some ways, it just really doesn't apply to our organization. It can feel like either it's way too cumbersome, like washing your car every day. It can feel like it's, frankly, so broad that it really doesn't apply. Like, you know, making sure you brush your teeth once a month. You know, not sure that'll really get you the benefits you're after when you're brushing your teeth. Hopefully this afternoon, my goal is to make internal controls practical. I want to leave you with five internal controls that I think every organization should have, and then I'll take questions, we can have some dialogue and so forth, but I think we'll just dive into this. There are handouts today. If those could be distributed, Myron, that would be great. And we're going to just dive in here with a few definitions, and then hopefully we can get a bit more practical on how it applies to your organization. So, what are internal controls? The American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, or AICPA, defines internal controls this way. Internal controls are a process affected or put in place by an entity's board of directors, management, and other personnel designed to provide reasonable assurance regarding the achievement of objectives in the following three categories. Three categories they give are effectiveness and efficiency of operations. In other words, are you doing what you say you're doing? Or what you claim to be about, is that what the organization is actually doing? It's also the achievement of objectives in the area of reliability of financial reporting. So when you issue a financial report, is that report accurate? Does it actually reflect what has been going on in your organization, whether it's income, whether it's expense, net profit, where the income is coming from? Is it coming from fundraising? Is it coming from what your organization is doing? So forth. And thirdly, compliance with applicable laws and regulations. How does your organization know if you are actually in compliance with the applicable laws? So if you're just in the tax and compliance workshop, things like charitable solicitation laws in states, does your organization have the assurance it needs that you are meeting these requirements, the requirements that might be in your particular state, in your particular line of business? So, providing reasonable assurance regarding the achievement of objectives in the following three categories: effectiveness and efficiency of operations, reliability of financial reporting, and compliance with applicable laws and regulations. They go on to say that internal controls can be judged as effective in each of these categories if the board of directors and management have reasonable assurance that they understand the extent to which the organization's operations objectives are being achieved. In other words, if management knows whether you are actually doing what you say you're doing, then they consider that your internal control in that area is working. Does management have reasonable assurance that published financial statements are being prepared reliably? So what are the controls in place in the financial aspect that the board can say, because of these controls, I now have assurance that our financial statements are accurate? And thirdly, that applicable laws and regulations are being complied with. If they have assurance that all these laws, because of the safeguards that we put into place, all applicable laws and regulations are being followed, that is then it's an effective implementation of those controls. Perhaps I could boil it down to what are internal controls? Internal controls are systems that ensure operations, financial reporting, and compliance with laws and regulations are being conducted with the utmost integrity. And I would put particular emphasis on the word systems and on the word integrity. internal controls have to be systematic. They have to be a part of what you do every day or every month or every year. If they're a, oh, now we're going to do this, and it'd be a good idea to, you know, let's run a checkup on, you know, this particular sector of our organization, and then that sector kind of goes for another year or two or three, and you kind of forget about it because, well, we did the checkup and it was fine, so, you know, we don't have to worry about it anymore. That's not internal controls. That is a necessary thing to do. And, you know, things like annual audits and so on are definitely important and valuable. But in terms of what we're talking about today, we're talking about the systems that you put in place in your organization that will help to ensure that you're doing what you say you're doing. Integrity is obviously the goal with any of these systems. And it has to be both the goal and the driving force. And I'll talk more about that later when I talk about sort of cost-benefit analysis. But integrity is the goal. And if what we're putting into place is we're putting something into place so that people are more convinced that we're doing what we say we're doing, but in reality it's just to put up a front so that they don't ask any questions, that's not integrity. That's not the point of internal controls. Internal controls is to demonstrate our integrity, but it's not to put something into place so that those who are looking on get a good idea, a good rosy picture of our organization when that isn't actually the case. So, why develop internal controls? I think there are a number of reasons why we should develop internal controls. Internal controls make integrity visible. And in this regard, I have to think of several examples that we see in Scripture. In 2 Corinthians, Paul's talking about how there were actually two brothers that went to Corinth to collect their gift that they were sending. I think it's a demonstration that, frankly, Paul believed in internal controls. You don't just send one person to get a huge gift, you know, whether it's gold or whatever, however they were giving this gift. You don't just send one person and then they give it to him and he picks up the bag and away he goes. Maybe it gets to where he's going and maybe it doesn't. Effective internal controls in this instance is sending two people. And he says, we're doing this, we're providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. I like what ECFA, the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability, says. They say, accountability to God is vital, but people form their impressions of people and organizations from looking at the outward appearance. It's true. Integrity to God, providing things honest in the sight of God, is of utmost importance, and internal controls won't work without that, quite frankly. But when it comes to developing internal controls, we're not thinking primarily about how we can be honest and have integrity toward God. While that's an aspect to it and has to be a driving force behind it, we're thinking primarily about what are people's opinions of our organization when they see what we're doing in our operations. So why develop internal controls? Internal controls make integrity visible. Jesus in John 3 said, and this is the condemnation, that light is come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in God. This afternoon we're talking about ways to come to the light, ways to make manifest that our deeds are right, and that they're wrought in God, and that we're frankly not scared of the light. Not only are we not scared of the light, we welcome the light, because it simply shows the integrity with which we are operating our organization. So internal controls make integrity visible. They also remove temptation. In Romans, Paul mentions about being careful not to put a stumbling block or an occasion to fall in our brother's way. You know, probably most of us would believe that stealing is not really a temptation for us. Frankly, I don't see that as being a big temptation. However, there are people who find that to be a big temptation. Just look at the headlines when all these scandals are uncovered in charitable organizations. This temptation, when internal controls are not in place, can be overwhelming for some people. And frankly, we don't develop internal controls only so that they don't steal. we're also looking out for our brother and saying, what are ways that I can actually remove the temptation from him? And it could even be removing the possibility that he would be blamed for something. Frankly, at Faith Builders, I'm glad we have the internal controls that we do, because if something goes wrong, I don't want people to look at me and say, yeah, he probably didn't do it, but boy, sure wonder where that money went. You know, I have these internal controls to protect my reputation. They also remove temptation, because frankly, how do you steal from an organization when all the dollars are accounted for? It makes it much more difficult. Internal controls are also an indication of something larger, and here's where it gets into a much broader picture that I won't go into a lot of detail in an organization, but internal controls do have to be a part of something larger. The IRS, when they redeveloped the Form 990 a number of years ago, included a couple questions on the 990, things like, does your organization have a conflict of interest policy? Does your organization have a document retention and destruction policy? There's a few, about half a dozen questions like that, and people said, oh, wait, what's this have to do with my money? What do you care whether I have a document retention and destruction policy when I'm reporting my income and expense? Like, where's the connection there? The IRS simply said, hey, we found a direct link between poor internal controls and inaccurate financial reporting. Easy as that. Well, now that makes sense. You know, if you think of an organization that, okay, frankly, I'm going to go into some specifics here. So if you donate to an organization and it's 6 months before your check is cashed, what does that say about the organization? I start to wonder what else they're, you know, delaying or fudging or mislaying or, you know, little things like that, that they're an indication of something much, much larger than only that particular internal control. So it's another reason to develop internal controls. They're an indication of something much larger. The worst case scenario in all of this is fraud, of course. We're trying to avoid fraud, but I would postulate that just like the problem with abortion, fraud is not the primary problem. Fraud is simply an indicator of a problem. And if we don't do something about, obviously if you don't do something about the underlying problem, you will have this issue that will come up, the issue of fraud, or, you know, the lifestyle that brings about the issue of abortion. If you take care of those underlying issues, you frankly won't even have to address that, hopefully we'll never have to address that, the crisis that comes with something like fraud. So what are some questions that that we ask when we think about internal controls and what internal controls we might need to develop? For an example, how can we minimize the temptation to steal from our organization? These are going to be questions that I just throw out there as something that you might consider when you're thinking about your organization. How can we minimize temptations to steal from organization? How can we eliminate the temptations to fudge the numbers? What are the things that we put in place to double check our reports that, you know, I, as the person who's in charge of issuing the report, I couldn't get away with just kind of, well, we'll kind of round that number a bit, up or down, and whether it's income or expense. And there are, frankly, motivations to do that sometimes. If you're issuing a report to donors, I prefer if it looks like we didn't make much money. Okay, I'm just being honest. You know, when somebody gets a financial report, if they're a donor and they see that, wow, they really had a big profit, okay, and they're asking for money, wonder why. You know, why don't they use up some of their surplus that they have? So, you know, it's kind of tempting to maybe fudge. I couldn't get away with that. There's too many internal controls we have in place that somebody would say, wait, that number's not accurate. What's the problem there? What are the areas that are most susceptible to misunderstanding from people outside the organization? How can we demonstrate integrity in those areas? I'm not going to go into detail here, but think in terms not only of what do we need to do to keep people in our organization from stealing from our organization, but what are the areas that we can demonstrate integrity to our constituents, to our donors, in ways that would be meaningful to them? Not only, it can be as simple as, Well, for us, one of the things we did was we became a member of the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. You might have seen the round ECFA logo. We did have to ask our auditor to include a separate schedule in our audit, but frankly, I did nothing different as part of becoming accredited. We were operating our organization in such a way that we met the requirements long before we actually went through the process of becoming accredited. Why did we become accredited? Because it demonstrates a certain amount of integrity to our donors. Not that it changed anything in our organization. It didn't change the way we did our operations, but it does demonstrate something that, oh, this is something we care about. Here's a tangible way that we care about this particular thing. So what are the areas that are most susceptible to misunderstanding from people outside the organization? How can we demonstrate integrity in those areas? Now I'm going to get into what I consider five crucial internal controls that every ministry should have. These, I'm sure, could be debated. This is, as I was developing the talk, these are the five that kept surfacing as ones that I would definitely want to see in place in any ministry that I might be involved in. The first is income verification. Now, what does that do? Basically, it ensures that income is reported accurately. What's that look like? It could be things like donation tracking, receipting, reporting, accounting software reconciliations. Specific examples here. So when a donation comes in, what's the process that your organization goes through between when the mail delivery person drops it in the box and when the bank teller processes your deposit? What do you do with it? Well, it depends. A lot of this stuff, frankly, depends on the organization, the size of your organization, and so on. But the one thing that is sort of overarching in a lot of this is the thing of segregation of duties. So you don't want the same person getting the mail, entering it in the accounting software, sending the donation receipt, preparing the deposit, taking it to the bank. If at all possible, segregate that somewhere between at least two people, if not more than that. One possibility, a client that I work with in my business, they have the treasurer actually goes to the post office, gets all the mail, and takes all the mail home. He takes the checks that are donation incomes. He opens all the envelopes, takes the checks out, lists them in a spreadsheet, and then puts them back in the envelope. So you know the postmark and so on is with them. Gives them to me. I actually handle all their bookkeeping for them. I then enter them in the accounting software, prepare the deposit, take them to the bank. After the deposit receipt comes back, I scan a copy to the treasurer. Treasurer takes a look at that, compares it to the donations that have come in, makes sure that the two match. It seems pretty common sense, but frankly, that's what we're talking about when we talk about internal controls. It's the systems that you put in place that you, here's the way we do this. Here's the, you know, and if a check would disappear somewhere along the line, or especially if cash would disappear, oh, then, you know, something doesn't come out right. Where's the problem? Another example would be to print donor restrictions or preferences on the receipt that you send to donors. This is a way of letting donors actually keep you accountable for what you give for. And I think, frankly, Christian Aid Ministries does an excellent job with this. Not only do they list specifically what you gave for, and so you can say, oh yeah, okay, they got it, and they entered it correctly. They'll be using it, you know, the way I said. Not only do they do that, they also are very, very prompt in their receipting. So you send them a donation, a week or two later, you get the receipt. Demonstrates a certain level of concern for the income that they're getting, and a desire to be upright and honest with the way that they're handling deposits and donations. Another thing that I mentioned here is accounting software reconciliations. That's simply reconciling the deposits that you make in your accounting software with the list of perhaps it's donation receipts that you send out. Some double check just to make sure that the accounting software is accurate in comparison to some other record of the donations that you received. Another area of internal controls that I think is very crucial is expense approvals. And this one can get as complicated or perhaps as simple as you want to make it. What do I mean here? It simply ensures that funds are used to further the stated purpose of the organization and according to donated intent. So, or according to donor intent. What do I mean by that? Several areas that you can look at: credit card expenditures, check writing and signing, bank statement reconciliations. A few examples at Faith Builders, when we have a when a bill comes in the mail, the head of the department that it applies to. Let's say it's an electric bill. The head of our operations opens the envelope, looks at the bill, and approves it, which basically in most cases involves pulling it out of the envelope. Wish it wasn't that high. Oh well, stick it in the envelope, stick it in my mailbox. It's a form of approval. When it shows up in my mailbox, the envelope's already open. I know that it's been approved. It's good to go. In some cases, we might want a more direct approval if it's, for myself, if I provide services to an organization before I pay the bill, it's nice to have like initials or something on to prove that they did approve that, because there could be some conflict of interest there, obviously. But in most cases, he sticks it in my mailbox and it's approved. At that point, it goes to the person in our office who does all the data entry. She takes it and enters it in our accounting software. I take the bill, print out the check. I give the check to our administrator. He signs the check, gives it back to our secretary. She mails it, files a bill in the paid bills file. What does this internal control do? It does a variety of things. One of the things it does, obviously, it does segregation of duties. So if I was to try to sneak an expense through the system, it'd be very difficult, because not only would I have to somehow bypass the check signing process, I would also have to try to bypass the data entry process. And some of those processes I do sometimes bypass, so that the person who does data entry isn't in the office and we need a check immediately. I'll print the check, I'll just bypass that step, go ahead and print the check. But I do not sign checks. I'm an authorized signer on the account. I could. However, here's another double check that we do, or another internal control that we have in place, and that is when the bank statement comes, it goes to our administrator, who, like I said before, signs all the checks, either him or another authorized signer in our organization. He gets the unopened bank statement. He opens it, looks at all the check images on the statement, which a lot of times you have to pay extra for that, but I do definitely recommend getting those check images so you can see whose signature is on the check. He makes sure his signature or the other authorized signer make sure those signatures are on all the checks, and then gives a statement to me to reconcile. Now, if I was to sign a check, I had better have a really good explanation as to why my signature shows up on a check. We just don't do that. It's something that it's just understood. I could, but I don't. It's an internal control that it would raise huge red flags if I would. The other thing that our statement reconciliation process does, the statement then comes to me. If our administrator was to write out a check without me knowing it, I would see it on the statement because I'm the one who balances the bank statement. What's that look like in a small organization? You might not have 10 people doing this process. I would recommend at least 2 people being involved in this, though. And it can be as simple as if someone's doing all the bookkeeping, writing all the checks, and sending them out, I'm fine with that, but I would definitely recommend someone else gets the bank statement and the unopened bank statement, just so that they can take a look at it, make sure all the expenses look correct and are all going toward the work of the organization, and can approve it, and then probably give it to the same person that wrote out all the checks so they can reconcile it. But at least you do have a second set of eyes on the entire process. Credit card expenditures can be in similar ways. If you have lots of people in your organization with credit cards, have a statement go to someone who possibly they have a credit card, but then it goes to someone else to pay it, so that neither one of them can slide expenses through on the credit card. Again, a lot of it is segregation of duties. You'll hear me talking about that over and over this afternoon. Cash protocols is the third thing that I would see as a very crucial part of internal controls for an organization. It eliminates temptations surrounding the organization's most slippery assets. If an organization is anything like my personal wallet. Cash just seems to disappear. That stuff is slippery as can be. I don't know where it always goes, but it disappears, if at all possible. What are some practical examples here? Well, access to petty cash funds. Who has access to these petty cash reconciliations? Cash income protocols. So, some examples. For access to petty cash fund, as much as possible, if you can keep it in either a locked or a very secure location and have only a few people know where the money is. Goes a long way toward money just disappearing. But that doesn't always ensure that money won't disappear. We had an instance of Faith Builders where there's $100 vanished from our cash box. I have no idea to this day where it went to. Kind of embarrassing. You know, here I am and talking about internal controls and we have this. But, you know, we stopped it at that. And there are going to be small discrepancies one way or the other with cash. There almost always are. But access to petty cash funds, you can keep that at a minimum. With the number of people that have access, it goes a long way there. Another example, I mentioned reconciling petty cash funds frequently. I would recommend, this one greatly depends on how much you're doing with cash. Monthly might be fine to reconcile it, quarterly might even be fine, depending how much, if you're doing very, very little in cash. I would recommend, though, do it more often than you think you need to, because, yeah, the sooner you can catch a problem, the better, and the sooner you reconcile it and realize that there's a problem, okay, we need to make an adjustment, that puts draws a line in the sand, and then the next time you reconcile it, you know that the problem wasn't back further than that, because, you know, if you reconcile every month, you have a possibility of saying, oh, where did that go? Oh yeah, that's right, I took this cash, I forgot to write it down. The longer that period goes, the less likely you're gonna remember what you did with that money, if it's a situation like that. So, reconcile them frequently. And in relation to cash income protocols, I would say if at all possible, have at least two people count the cash that's coming in. And when they count it, write the amount in ink, write the amount, and have them initial it and date it. It goes a long way toward knowing how much is in that envelope, and if that same amount isn't in later, well, you know who verified it. It wasn't just one person that counted it and two bills stuck together. It was two people counted it, verified the information, and goes a long way toward discrepancies. If you need an example of that, this evening when we take an offering here at Reach, I know there'll be probably three or four of us that will be taking the money to a separate room. We will be counting it together, we'll be notating the amounts, and we'll be initialing them. It's just part of what we do at Faith Builders. There are instances where, you know, it might not work to do that, it might not be practical to do some of those controls, but if at all possible, have at least two people involved in cash. A third policy that I would say every organization should have is a conflict of interest policy. This policy communicates a concern for integrity and a commitment to the mission of the organization. It demonstrates that you're more concerned about the mission of the organization than you are about maybe personal convenience or padding my pocket or the pockets of somebody that's related to me. Some examples, when you hire family members, what do you take into consideration before you just hire them? When you contract with a related party, when there's someone in your organization that's benefiting from your organization's mission. So some examples, and frankly, I would say this is often an example more of more consideration of how it looks than how it actually is. What would people think if they knew that I hired my father to mow the lawn for our organization? Interesting. If you're related to somebody that works at the organization, you have a lot better chance of getting the job. You know, that's the kind of thing that frankly can be thought about your organization. Keep that in mind. You know, somebody is doing some odd jobs around the organization. It's like, well, I would have volunteered to do that for free, but they didn't ask because that person's related, so they're paying them to do it. What are the policies that you have in place to ensure that type of insider trading, or whatever you want to call it, isn't actually taking place the way it looks. So a couple examples. And I'll pick on the bottom one there. Benefiting from an organization's mission, we operate a scholarship fund at Faith Builders. Do quite a lot of processing for funds because of a state tax credit in Pennsylvania. Won't get into all those details. But what happens when a patron or when an employee has children at our day school there at Faith Builders, and they apply for a scholarship from the Scholarship Foundation? Nothing wrong with giving them a scholarship. Quite frankly, it goes along with the mission of the organization. They're low income, maybe because they work for a nonprofit. They qualify for this scholarship. What controls do we have in place to ensure that it doesn't look like we're just giving it to them because they work there? In our particular case, we have a policy that says any transaction with a related party, if it's over $1,000, estimated to be over $1,000 per year, we will get board approval, or we'll disclose it to the board as part of our regular reporting to the board. So any scholarship that is given over $1,000, if it's to an employee of the organization, the board will see that. They have the option to ask questions. They have the option to, say, no, you shouldn't be doing this. Simply a way of disclosing it to them. Now, we set the threshold at $1,000 to keep it a practical policy. I don't want to have to say, oh, yeah, we paid our administrator's wife $50 to come in and help for, a few hours in the office. Really, does the board want to see that? I doubt it. But if it's over a certain threshold, excellent idea to disclose it to the board. Just let them know what's going on there. And as a way of keeping us accountable to them and, through them, accountable to our donors. Another suggestion would be, when at all possible, get quotes for comparable services from other organizations. So as Myron mentioned, I do have a business providing tax and accounting services in addition to the work that I do at Faith Builders. One of the things I provide is payroll services. And Faith Builders has contracted with me as a subcontractor to provide those services to Faith Builders. Well, before they signed the contract, I got a quote from Paychex, a very well-known organization, saying, what would you charge to do this payroll? And so they came in, they did an analysis, said, okay, here's what we would charge. I figured I knew how it was going to come out. Sure enough, they shot over what I was going to do it for, because frankly, I care about the organization. I try to give discounts to nonprofits whenever possible. So I figured I was going to come in under their quote. I did, but that quote formed the basis of saying, yes, we're contracting with a related party. Here's why. It benefits the organization. Why wouldn't you, if you can save money on these services? So something to keep in mind, if at all possible, get a quote from someone else, or have some backing to say, here's why we're doing it, because here's what it'd cost if we wouldn't. The fifth policy, I believe, is very important, is a compensation policy. And I mentioned this afternoon more because the IRS is very concerned about this than because I think it's a huge issue in our constituency. However, it is a big deal in the nonprofit world in general. Demonstrates a greater concern for the mission than for personal gain. What are some examples? Well, who sets the director's salary? How do you know the salaries that are paid are fair? These are the kinds of questions that the IRS is going to be asking. For most of our organizations, anybody who looks over our financials wouldn't get the idea that we're greatly inflating our wages for our workers. But this is a way of saying we do care about this, and we are concerned about how we set these salaries. I would definitely recommend that the board of directors would set, or at a minimum approve, the salaries for the administrative level people in your organization. And a salary should be periodically reviewed for fairness as compared to similar positions in other nonprofits. You can also compare them to similar positions in for-profit organizations, but that's not going to... Then you'll probably look way undervalued for the services you pay. I recommend comparing them to other nonprofits, which makes a lot more sense in terms of keeping you accountable there. A lot of nonprofits, frankly, in my experience, are somewhat open with this information. It also often appears on the 990 for administrative personnel. It shows up on the 990 how much you're actually paying them, so it is public information for a lot of the top people in the organization. So, five different types of policies that I've mentioned here. At this point, I'm going to open it up if you have any questions as far as what I'm talking about and so forth. What are the specifics that you run into that you have questions about? And maybe I'll kick it off with a question. So who sets these internal controls? Is it the board? Is it management? Is it employees? Who actually sets these controls? And to that, I would say it depends. It depends on the policy. So the point of a, and it also depends on the size of an organization. So the point of a board is to provide, typically is to provide broad level policies and procedures that the people within the organization can then take it and run with it. So in our case, the board says, we want to know if you have a conflict of interest over $1,000. Okay, there's a policy that the board has set. Internally, we might say, yeah, that's true, but if there's actually any conflict of interest or related party transaction, we'd like the administrative team to look at it. That to me is a fair way of saying, okay, the board provides a big picture, the management and directors can break it down, maybe make it more practical. The board says, you know, we want accurate financial reports, and as a result, we have said, okay, as personnel there, we now say, okay, in order to make sure they get that, we are going to, you know, have one person enter the bill, have another person pay the bill, have a third person sign the check. The management has to make a lot of those small decisions as to how are we going to implement all this, but the board should definitely be involved, I believe, in setting the broad structure for how that operates. Any questions? Right. Appreciate that, Mark. There's a couple things I would say along with that. I mean, one is that it is a demonstration of integrity, even if maybe we don't think it's necessary. The other is that, frankly, okay, today you might trust everybody in your office. Tomorrow you might want to hire someone that, you know, we're going to give them a second chance. We'll have them do some work in the office. It's a little embarrassing at that point to have to all of a sudden make a bunch of, okay, now we're going to do things this way and that way. You know, we're going to make sure that everything's done right. You don't want to have to go there. You want to set the controls long before there's a problem. I appreciate what you're saying, that it's definitely practical even in Anabaptist organizations. Excellent question. Believe it or not, the AICPA, American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, actually says, I don't know if I have their wording anywhere in my notes here, but they make a comment, something about needing to keep in mind the available resources of the organization. What they're basically saying is you have to do a cost-benefit analysis. And there are instances in which you might be trying to wash your car every day. It is actually too time-consuming. However, I would say, in response to that, possibly we're doing something that is more complicated than it needs to be, but I would far rather spend more time being more cautious than what I need to be than less time and wind up with a calamity. That's not necessarily a good answer in every case, but for example, I would much rather give to an organization who has internal controls in place and that I know is operating with that level of integrity, rather than one that does not. Not that I don't trust the office personnel, but you don't hand over your keys to a 14-year-old and say, well, you know, I wouldn't expect you to you know, actually use the car for anything, but here are the keys, you know, in case you, I don't know, need them or something. You know, there are certain controls that are, yeah, you just don't go there. And sometimes those aren't obvious on the surface as to why we do what we do, but can still be important. I don't know. Maybe, Mark, do you maybe have a better response there, what you've experienced? Thank you, Mark. And just for the sake of the recording, yeah, just sort of maybe restating what you're saying, the orientation of new board members can be very important there, explaining why we do what we do. Maybe if I would say sort of an extension of that, sometimes it helps if you think about what would happen if we would not be doing this and someone would feel a temptation to steal from the organization or something like that.
The board needs to be assured that the assets of the organization are being safe, right?
Right, yes.
Those controls are there to talk about. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Is there any issues with your internal controls on receiving cash in the mail? Is that something that happens so infrequently that it's non-issue?
Non-issue. The question is, what about receiving cash donations in the mail? That can be an issue. I don't know how to get around that. I guess security cameras might. But you know, there's a certain level in our organization that's been very infrequent, but I'm sure it happens sometimes. I would say one of the things is just having more people around. Having multiple people in an office can do a lot to curb that. If I was in the office and our secretary opened an envelope and had a lot of cash in it, it'd be like, oh, okay. You know, maybe we need to do something about this. So, you know, just a presence and an awareness. In that case, now, if it's an anonymous donation that came through the mail, no return address, etc., that's going to be very hard to control. Because, frankly, there's probably one person that opened the envelope, no receipts being issued. If a receipt is being issued, that's a big internal control. Because the donor checks the receipt and says, yes, this is how much I gave. Not only that, the donation, hopefully the receipting process, is also linked to the accounting process in such a way that you can't receipt something without depositing it. And I would say, yeah, it's good to have those two systems at least somewhat separate and reconcile the two so that you receipt something, it has to be deposited or else something won't come out right. So yeah, excellent question. Any other questions?
On the other side of that, I think, and we can't set that as an organization, but I think large cash donations isn't a good way to go. Even if, you know, to be anonymous, right. there's other checks and balances of or other ways of doing that. I think obviously we can't control that on the incoming, but it is a challenge to handle that.
One of the most unique situations I've ever experienced in that regard was a donor who sent us a large money order and requested that we mail the receipt to a post office box. To this day, I have no idea who they were, but they got the receipt. And I have no doubt they can take it off for tax purposes, but I had never thought of that way of giving anonymously but still taking it off your tax return. That was interesting. I'd never seen that done before, but it worked. Can't say I didn't kind of try to figure out who it was.
Sorry. Didn't have a name to put on the receipt.
We did not.
I'm not sure how they can do it.
But to my knowledge, a name is not required on the receipt. Is a donor name required on a receipt? So Salvation Army, I drop off a bag of clothes, they scribble out a receipt and hand it to me. I don't think they put my name on it. Like, my response was the same. Initially, I was like, well, we have to have a name. Well, maybe we don't. Anyway.
I
don't know. Like I said, it was a unique situation. I've never seen it before or since. And anyway, kind of interesting.
Yeah, I work in a real estate office, and we do not allow tenants mainly to bring cash.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that gives our staff some comfort because years ago,
right,
we had some disappear. another agent took it. Interesting story, actually. It's about 10 years ago. The agent claimed he put it in the other agent's box. Wasn't there. He made it good. We're talking $650. We found that money last week.
No kidding.
He had put it in an envelope and put it with some other stuff and forgot about it. He's even no longer at our office. But
Wow.
So we don't allow cash. We make them go out and get money orders.
Right.
And pay for it now. That's a little tougher with people that are donating money. But,
right. One of my mantras is never make it difficult for people to give you money. I go by that. If, you know, I've had several situations that come up in the office and they're like, well, you know, can we do, I say, take it. We'll figure out what to do with it later. I mean, sort of. I don't violate internal controls to do that. But frankly, don't make it difficult for people to give you money. I mean, why would you? You can figure out a way of doing that. Okay, I'm just gonna briefly run through. If my computer will cooperate here. For some reason, it's not going on to the next slide. But three ways why internal controls can break down. I'm just going to mention these for you to keep in mind. I think I have them printed on your handout. The first is if internal controls are too broad. Like I mentioned, if they're so broad that you can drive a truck through them, you know, they're pointless. They're really not going to work. If internal controls are too cumbersome, this is the flip side. If you have to go through all this minutia to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, you're going to probably not go by your policy because it's too cumbersome. And then the third is that there's management override of controls. And this one, I really don't know what to do about. So for myself, like I said, I can approve bills, enter them, and pay them. Management can do things that, you know, if you trust management, they say, well, do this, and it'll be fine. You know, what option do you have? So there are places where internal controls do break down. Keep those in mind when you're developing your internal controls. That's all I have. Thank you very much for attending, and I wish you the best in developing your systems that will help to demonstrate integrity to your donors. Thank you.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.